Connecting our city and South Cambridgeshire. Cambridge 105 Radio.
Cambridge is right, this sort of thing.
What's it like? Ambitious.
Good afternoon, and now we move swiftly on from news to nourishment. And thanks to Ollie Slack for the Cambridgeshire Football Show, now it's time for Alan Alder, Sue Bailey and myself, Matt Bentman, with an hour of flavour, food and drink in and around Cambridge.
Today we celebrate the tomato with ideas from local chefs.
The juice comes out, slightly caramelises. Go down to your local bakery, get some crusty bread, put those roasted tomatoes on the table and just dip away.
Laura Donoghue is back with an essay about tomatoes.
And there is a hidden gem in southeast Cambridge where a remarkably green-fingered woman named Kay Andreu grows some of the most ravishingly delicious and bonny tomatoes I have eaten since childhood. Some huge, weighing over a kilo, yet firm, juicy, intense.
Away from tomatoes, Steve Thompson of the Green Man in Grantchester goes foraging and fermenting.
So honey on its own won't ferment, but if you add a little bit of liquid to honey, or like we're going to do, add the blackberries, which will release the liquid into the honey, it then allows fermentation to happen.
And we visit Vanderlyle in Mill Road to see what's cooking.
So essentially we've taken onions, fennel and pine nuts and cooked them down with the strawberries for about 7 to 8 hours, and they almost start taking on kind of a beefy kind of flavour.
And you can email us at any time, flavour@cambridge105.co.uk, or tweet at flavour105.
Okay, so let's get started. Now, Flavour has been on the air for about 12 years. Not about, actually 12 years. And we've covered so many independents in that time. But one question that's always interested me is how people got started. Was it by accident or by design? So here is a mixture of voices, starting perhaps with the most flamboyant, Cambridge's own Tristan Welch of Parker's Tavern on Regent Street.
I'm sitting here, buck naked, on doing a radio
exactly,
show.
Exactly.
So, yeah, you could call that flamboyant. Yep, I'm from just outside Cambridge, and Cambridge is where it really started for me, actually. My first job was working for Gay Rhodes in London. So he was on tour, and he did a date at the Corn Exchange. Like a groupie, I was a young college student in those days. I hung around, and I wanted his autograph. He lives in Dubai now, actually. And actually, at really, really sort of poignant points in my career, Gay Rhodes just turned up. So it's been really lovely.
So you sort of talked your way into your first job, did you, with him?
Yeah, I did. So I asked for his autograph, and then I said, can I have a job, please? So he said, here's a number to my kitchen, here's a number for my head chef, give him a call and see where it goes. And his head chef said, oh, could you wait a month? And then so I called back, and I called back, and I kept on calling once a month for about 3-4 months, and eventually said, why didn't you come and have a look? And I went and did a day's trial, and I fell in love with it instantly, offered me a job, and that was it. I think I was 17 years old and off on my way to London, and that's how it all started.
Deborah Bonnies of Biscotti to Deborah got switched on to cooking.
Ah, since the very, very beginning. I baked my first cake when I was around 4 or 5. My uncle, he came to visit. He would always bring a big present for me. Yeah. And he bought a toy oven that I was already dreaming about, and he actually bought it for me. And yes, that's when I cooked my first cake. It was actually made with 2 lamp bulbs. Yes, and
it was a proper working
cake. Yeah, it was. The whole thing provided very thin baking trays that would become hot enough to cook. And there was a special booklet with special recipes. And with the help of my mum, I did a few of them. So, yeah, and yes, I made excellent pizzas with toast bread in the oven. Yes, so that was, yeah, from the very, very beginning. Yeah.
Cameron Clark runs a stall on Cambridge Market called the Haluman. He sells portions of halloumi cheese as freshly fried golden brown fries, drizzled in white yogurt, flecks of green thyme, ruby red pomegranates and fresh mint. Now here's how he started out.
So when I was a lot younger than I am now, I had the opportunity to work in their Michelin starred restaurants here and in France as well. And then about 8 years ago, we had a mad idea of opening up a restaurant in Italy. So we sold our house in Cambridge and went to Italy and opened up a restaurant, which was brilliant. That didn't quite work out, opened up in the recession and came back to Cambridge, where I went back into food manufacturing. And then I decided to open up something on the market. So I came up with an idea of doing something that nobody else was doing, which was halloumi fries. And my son came up with the idea of calling it Halloo-man. He doesn't help me anymore, though. No, he's disappeared. So but yeah, started up. So everything I do here is vegetarian, but it all has halloumi one way or the other.
A few aisles across from the Halloo Man at Cambridge Market are Tim and Elena Henderson. Now they run the Warden House stall, selling apples, honey, veg, flowers, all grown from their home, and all at a suggestion.
I used to fly aeroplanes. I was an airline pilot for 22 years. I started from university studying astrophysics. I then went on to do a postgraduate degree in aeronautics. I then worked for British Airways for 5 years. I then got made redundant. During the redundancy period, I went out and studied commercial horticulture at a place called Oaklands, which was the College of Agriculture and Horticulture in St Albans. I kept the knowledge from that. And it's purely by chance with a colleague I used to fly with who used to buy honey off me. He came to visit us. He looked at the garden, he looked at what we had, and he said, "Why aren't you selling on Cambridge Market?" And I said, "Good question." He said, "If you come to the Cambridge Market on a Sunday, it's a growers and farmers market." And I thought, do you know, that's such a good idea. I'm embarrassed to think I have never thought of it. It never occurred to me. So we applied and we come here every Sunday, 7 o'clock in the morning till 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and we're delighted to see anybody who wants to come say hello, and they can have a free taste of our honey, and usually they buy.
Whilst over at the Gardenia on Rose Crescent, owner Vaz realised that cooking has been in his blood for generations. He started off as a genetic engineer at Cambridge University.
I was working with genetic modified food, which was not ethically right for me and my family, my background. So Gardenia was available, I was working here part-time. And when it became available, actually when McDonald's opened, the proprietor of Gardenia, he was like shaking, like, you're not going to have business. So I jumped in, so I asked my dad to give me a family to start this place. And he gave me the money. He was a little bit upset because he said to me, after private schools and high education, you're going to open a restaurant sort of thing. I told him that there's no restaurant, it's a place in Cambridge, it's a place next to universities. I like it, I feel good here. It's multicultural society, yeah. It's a cosmopolitan place. So that would happen. That's how I start here. I put more effort to learn about food than my genetic engineering job. So when I got involved with Gardenia, I thought I'm going to create a menu and an atmosphere like fairy tale, optimistic. My grandfather was in construction business, yeah. But he loved cooking. He was a local celebrity. They used to call him. Always he used to go without money, and he used to cook for the villages around because he loved it. And he never cooked the same dish twice, which is the same for me sometimes. If I cook for my friends or my family, I never cook the same food twice because I don't remember exactly. I go with my feelings. I go with what I have around me.
So you've spent half your life, more than half your life in Cambridge?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
More than... No, in Cambridge, in Gardenia, I can say. I spent a lot of time here because, I don't know, I always felt comfortable here. That's why I'm here. I felt comfortable. It's a good energy around here for some reason. Good energy, strong energy.
Robin Platt of Kura Kura, the Sri Lankan street food van, also found that his family have roots embedded in the food industry, despite having no initial intention himself.
No, far from it. I've spent the best part of 30 years in civil engineering. Worked in a soils testing laboratory, testing soil for foundation design, tunnel design, big prestigious projects around the world. But I've always loved cooking. So I got very geeky with food. Geeky full stop, I think. Probably, yeah there you go. The wife agrees. I'll get it in there first. But yeah, I like researching, like studying.
So just books,
yeah, thousands and thousands of books, and just started researching the different regions and finding out the difference between the different regions, and started a little cooking travel, not traveling physically, if you haven't been there, but started to cook regionally. Hit Sri Lankan, loved it from the start. Absolutely loved the food, and yeah, my dad's dad on his side of the family. Yeah, we always knew, and they're from the East End. Probably guess from my Birmingham accent. And they had pie mashups. and fish and chip shops. Direct relationship to Malin's,
yeah,
which is in East End, which is the very first ever fish and chip shop. So, yeah, that's my claim to fame. Proud of that. Very proud of that.
I was wondering, does it give you a sense of here, where, yeah, what you're doing here today?
Not, you know, that far off?
Yeah, yeah, like not a coincidence in,
yeah,
a way.
Yeah, yeah, maybe it's in the blood. I don't know. But yeah, I'm happy with that. I'll go with that one.
And finally, here's Sam and Alex Carter of Restaurant 22 on Mitcham's Corner. And since taking on the restaurant last year, they have received so many plaudits for their imaginative dishes. I met them a week before opening, and Sam is the first in his family to take on cooking as a profession.
I started washing up and working in pubs. My mum and dad never really used to cook that much.
If your mum, yeah, if heard you that, say
if
that.
If she heard that now, she'd probably get quiet.
Yeah.
She started cooking now, and she's pretty good.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm just saying that so she hears.
Yeah.
But yeah, she's pretty good. But no, I just started working in pubs and just love the atmosphere, love the environment. Every chef starts off being a kitchen porter, I think. It was a tough environment, very demanding, high pressure. The restaurant that I was at, Maze, it was Michelin star, but it was high volume as well.
Mm.
And just off Oxford Street, I mean, it was sort of 120 for lunch, 140 for dinner. And it's still keeping that Michelin star standard that obviously Jason Atherton created. And then it just carried on from there. And working at that intensity,
yeah, yeah,
with those standards, I mean, it's a brilliant place to learn.
I remember the hours that Sam was doing at that time. It was just incredible, but he did so much and learned so much there. I think those lessons will stick with you forever. You really cut your teeth there, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a great learning environment, and working with some of the chefs in that kitchen, incredible chefs. And obviously, if you surround yourself by talented people, you pick up their skills, and that's definitely what we did.
It's like an addiction almost, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
The kitchen is, the buzz of the kitchen.
It goes further than the kitchen. I mean, the restaurant industry, there's sommeliers, there's restaurant managers, yeah, there's restaurateurs. I mean, it's a bug, and I think you're never going to make a huge profit from it, but I think having your own restaurant is something that we're really looking forward to, and if you don't want to do it, then people will soon leave. But I think we're definitely committed to it, and hopefully we're going to make a success of it. Triste é viver na solidão.
Yeah, nice to be able to go back and hear those voices again. And also just to finish off with that reminder from Sam Carter that truly anybody can cook. I'm free.
I'm free. And here's news of free food available now, Saturday, in and around Cambridge. You can find this information on the Olio app. And if you're listening to a repeat or to the podcast, check the Olio app for what's currently available, free to download.
Yeah, so looking at what's on today, the efficiently named V, that's just the letter V, she's flooded Olio and its feed with bottles of Heinz mayonnaise, ketchup, barbecue sauce, raspberry conserve, Twinings Everyday Tea, PG Tips, and a 600-gram pack of bacon to give away. V lives on Catherine Street, which is off Mill Road on the Romsey side, and you can contact her to arrange pickup times. Now, this next one is a reminder to keep an eye on the Olio app as often as you can, because things move fast, and Olga is giving away pret-a-manger sandwiches, 2x tuna mayo, 3x egg mayo, chicken Caesar bacon baguettes, ham and grieve baguettes. These all had to be gone this morning, sadly, but what great offers. So, you know, you really do have to catch them quick. Now, Ethel is giving away a jar of sourdough starter. She's near St. John's College, Byron House School. She can leave the jar outside for you to pick up. And finally, Tracy is giving away a kilogram bag of seitan. She's located centrally near St. Andrew's the Great Church, and that bag is available for pickup anytime.
Brilliant. Now, in her second essay for Flavour, here is Laura Donoghue, 3x finalist of the Guild of Food Writers Blog Award, on the fall and rise of the tomato.
Summer has certainly been elusive this year, but it's still summer. Its exuberant harvest is glutting our fields and markets despite the weather's ups and downs. This is the time when fresh food is fast food, when a few choice tomatoes and some good olive oil can make your eyes open wide, and simpler meals, eaten outdoors on those few lucky days when we can complain of the heat, tune us into life's radiant beauty and compensate for those when rain flattens the petunias and blights our garden tomatoes. Every summer about this time, I feel twinges of tomato anxiety, hopeful but never taking for granted that I'll find some really good ones that taste like they should. I grew up in rural South Jersey, literally surrounded by open fields of sun-ripened tomatoes in the days when they tasted as glorious as they looked. Our family ate them every day through the eight-week season, and we kids trespassed freely in the fields, hurling tomatoes at each other in remorseless horseplay and score settling that left us covered in juice and pulp. The farmer who grew them, a gentle Quaker, hardworking at the plow and in the local pork house his family had run since the Civil War, either didn't know or let it go. He rented the fields from the same landlord who owned the old farmhouse we lived in, and he knew us to be just one of many pests, and mostly harmless. We plundered his tomatoes to fry green or slice ripe or fill with ham salad. We cooked them into sauces to go with eggplant rolls and stuffed peppers and squash fritters. I remember how good they were, how glad we were to have them. I remember the plenty. When I can't get a tomato as good as those were, it feels like something's missing, that summer's passed me by. But alas, the poor, abused, and maligned tomato is also symbolic of what's gone wrong in post-war industrialized agriculture and our modern food system. And while things have gotten much better in the past few years, and the tomato is recovering in some measure at least from its decades of flavorlessness, a really good tomato, even in season, still has to be sought out. Flavor is governed by the plant's variety, firstly, but also by how it's grown, the health of the soil, how ripe the crop is when harvested, and freshness, how long it takes to get to our tables. The tomatoes of my childhood were the last of the flavorsome commercial varieties that flourished between the 1930s and 70s, before mechanized harvesting and centralized processing demanded high-yielding, hard-skinned varieties with long shelf life, suitable for transport. Jersey tomatoes were famous for flavor, and a 1934 variety called Rutgers, developed by the State University of that name, was the most widely grown commercial variety between 1950 and 1970, accounting for 60 to 70% of all crops worldwide. Our tomatoes, as we thought of them, were destined for the processing plants of Campbell's and its famous tomato soup. The same variety was also superior for eating fresh, and made its way to the roadside stands you could find outside every farm in the days before such sights were considered quaint, long before farm shops became trendy or were even thought of. This was the era of Silent Spring, Vietnam, the burgeoning civil rights and women's movements. So much was amiss, but there was no need yet for a renaissance in tomatoes with flavor, for those imperfectly round, meaty red beefsteaks were so good we looked forward to them all year, and they were the norm. We didn't know we were taking for granted the golden age of the tomato, nor that the end of our own golden age in the country would coincide with the demise of the tomato's flavor. By the early 70s, the small-scale family farming that had been common for generations in South Jersey could no longer hold its own against large agribusiness, and farmland was worth far more for development. The acres that afforded our rural idyll were sold to become a housing estate, and we moved to town, bereft of our country playground and its expansive freedoms. By the time I'd graduated from college and my sisters were studying their own degrees, the entire industry had changed, and the good-tasting tomato went out of production and was virtually lost. Our family's personal story was part of a bigger economic and technological story. Our upheaval was part of a global upheaval, had we but known it. Many factors led to this loss, from the labor disputes and boycotts that dogged companies like Campbell's, to the entrenched resistance to investing in better lives for exploited migrant workers who picked the crops, and the economies of scale afforded by cheap fuel and proliferating interstate highways, which made transporting produce to centralized mass processing plants in other states cheaper than staying local. Flavor did not feature in a single breeding trial during this period. It was the industrialization of the entire food supply chain that changed the flavor of the tomato worldwide, and not just in South Jersey. Consumer power in North America and Europe did eventually, to some degree at least, reject the tasteless tomato. Heirloom tomatoes, grown over a century before, re-entered the market in the 1990s, welcomed by people who were willing and able to pay a premium for an alternative. But the heirloom's low yield, fragility, problems with fungal disease, and tendency to split were problematic. The industry realized it was missing a trick, and breeders embarked on developing a tomato that would be commercially viable, but still have flavor consumers would approve. They looked to older varieties and even the wild ancestors of commercial crops to bring new genetic material into what is, in the case of the tomato, one of the most inbred crops we have managed to develop throughout the history of agriculture. In 2014, a major international study published the genetic sequences of 360 tomato varieties, far more than was previously available, making it possible for breeders to select traits from a much greater diversity of genetic material. Today, industry still relies on standardized varieties for predictable yields. So while it's invested recently in improving the flavor of some varieties, notably cherry tomatoes like Piccolo and Pomodorino, which are priced accordingly, its priorities are still predominantly productivity, uniformity, growing times, and the ability to survive haulage and storage. All the cost drivers that, it has to be said, come partly from the pressure to keep food costs for consumers one of the lowest per capita in the world. In the UK, we only produce 20% of the tomatoes we consume. The rest come from the EU, especially Holland, Spain, and Italy. Most tomatoes are grown in polytunnels or glasshouses, sometimes on a vast scale, increasingly using hydroponics, where plants are grown in a soil substitute and fed a nutrient solution. Glasshouses extend the growing season and protect against the elements, and can reduce the use of pesticides, as biological controls can be used in them effectively, and pollinators can also be well supported. Some glasshouse growers are choosing to let the fruits ripen longer on the vine, as they don't have to second-guess the weather when harvesting, and these fruits can command a higher price. Many commercial tomatoes, including so-called vine-ripened, are picked at the stage known in the industry as mature green, when they have begun to break, i.e. they're pink over 10% of the surface, or to turn, they're pink over 11 to 29% of the surface. These mature green fruits are transported to storage facilities where they're ripened artificially with ethylene, the gas that fruits produce naturally as they ripen, and refrigerated until they can be displayed on cool supermarket shelves. But as every tomato enthusiast knows, refrigeration kills a tomato's flavor, whether at home or in a warehouse. Smaller growers who don't have to produce on a vast scale are often the ones to grow varieties that are best for flavor, and to grow a greater diversity of varieties with nuanced and interesting flavors. Small producers are also those who tend to work with the seasons, who don't push plants on with excess water, fertilizers, and heat, and are most likely to pick produce when properly ripe. We're blessed in Cambridgeshire with local growers who care passionately about flavor and use the varieties and methods to produce it. Wild Country Organics, based in Great Abington, counts 40 types of tomato amongst its range of organic produce, and Waterland Organics in Lode grows some of the nicest golden pear cherry tomatoes I've tasted. Small-scale horticulture won't feed the world, but these dedicated growers are a blessing to be treasured, bringing us such pleasure in our food, raising our expectations of flavor, and expanding the diversity of the plant gene pool by keeping flavorful varieties in circulation. And there is a hidden gem in Southeast Cambridge where a remarkably green-fingered woman named Kay Andreu grows some of the most ravishingly delicious and bonny tomatoes I have eaten since childhood, some huge, weighing over a kilo, yet firm, juicy, intense. Kay brought the seeds back from her native Cyprus years ago, and practices selective breeding by saving the seeds of the best fruits every year to sow the next. She grows 7 varieties of large and medium tomatoes, all chosen for flavor, and 4 types of cherry tomatoes in a rainbow of orange, reds, and yellow. Kay owns and operates the Great Abington Cherry Orchard, which she took on with her beloved late husband, Steve, 17 years ago, after many years in Cambridge. Located near Granta Park, just off the old A11 in the area known as the Land Settlements, the cherry orchard produces gorgeous fruit through its short season from June to July, which you can buy right there where they're harvested every morning. It's a challenging but rewarding crop and was Steve's passion, so Kay tends it in his memory and for the pleasure those cherries bring to her customers. The large and handsome greenhouse where the tender beefsteak and heritage varieties of tomato grow so impressively has always been Kay's own domain. It is a gorgeously fruitful, healthy, varied, and well-tended glasshouse, its roof dripping with cucumbers. Row after row of fine tomato plants reach the ceiling, their heavy fruits holding well under robust foliage. There are tubs of aubergine, white, violet, glossy black, and striped, and huge pots of basil, flat-leafed parsley, and the most intensely fragrant rose-scented pelargonium, which Kay uses to flavor the syrups for her traditional pastries. She does all the glasshouse work herself, from sowing to pricking out and planting up, staking, weeding, watering, feeding, and harvesting. Her tomatoes are grown in soil, topped up with compost. She never sprays and deals with any pests by hand with biofriendly means. The day I was there, the plants were buzzing with bumblebees and hoverflies. In the garden just outside the glasshouse, there are outdoor varieties of tomato sharing space with courgettes, artichokes, a mature fig tree, pristine stands of sage and lemon balm, and an enormous grapevine, the leaves of which Kay uses for making dolmafes. Everything is a feast for the senses and beautiful. Kay sells her tomatoes and other late summer produce by advance order as she's busy tending the orchard, gardens, and greenhouse. If you text Kay and tell her what you want, she'll have it ready for you. Those in the know order flats of tomatoes to preserve or freeze for winter sauces and soups. When I drove away with my tomatoes, cucumbers, aubergine, and herbs, the car smelled like a garden, and I knew I'd touched on something very special. It couldn't have been more different from buying a pack of tomatoes from the supermarket. The immediacy of seeing those tomatoes harvested from the plant, grown by the woman who planted them, made me feel more rooted to this land I've made my adult home, as far from the home of my birth as Kay is from hers. This kind of experience is so rare now, and its value extends beyond flavor to a sense of connectedness with people and place and the universality of the earth and what grows in it. It's striking and humbling how good it feels when we can experience that. A tomato is sometimes just a tomato, but the power of something so elemental as the pleasure of flavor is profound and profoundly worth stewarding by those who grow and those who appreciate and support them. I'm grateful to all those who keep at it.
And we're grateful too. That was Laura Donoghue. Her blog can be found at crumbsonthetable.co.uk. Not only are there Laura's food stories there, but there are tried and tested recipes as well.
Yeah, and you can order tomatoes and other seasonal produce from the Great Abington Cherry Orchard Laura mentioned until mid-September by texting Kay Andreu at 07990 582 398. And you can find Wild Country Organics and Waterland Organics in various markets, farm shops and other outlets across Cambridge, including Cofco, which is the organic food company, which make deliveries in the area through its box scheme, and at Arjuna Whole Foods on Mill Road. Waterland Organics also has its own veg box delivery scheme.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105 Radio. We have some local chefs with ideas for cooking tomatoes coming up, and we'll be catching up with news from Van der Lyle in Mill Road too. But first, here's another local chef, Steve Thompson of the Green Man in Grantchester, who has some foraging and fermenting tips for August.
This month we're looking at fruit. The last time we looked at what we did with the unripe fruit, this time we're going to look what we're doing with the ripened fruit and ripened berries at the moment. So first of all, well, we're sat under a plum tree. It's not been a great year for plums. I find they tend to be every other year. Well, probably what we'll find when the sloes are coming out and ripening up is that that's the same with the sloes. pretty much all the prunus type plants are the same every other year. But we've still had enough to make a good quantity of jam. I find on the years when we have really, really good harvest, then we can do loads of different things with them. But on the other years, jam is still simple and the best. What's looking better this year, however, is the elderberries. So they're just starting to ripen up now. If you start looking up some plants, the ones that are in full sun all day, they'll be ripening now. The other ones probably a week or two away. And what we're going to do with those is lactoferment. Lactofermenting is turning the natural sugars in the berries into lactic acid, which is the preservative. All we basically do is we make a 3% brine, so that's 3% salt to the water, make sure everything is completely sterile, and then pour that over the elderberries, and then we leave them to sit for about 3 months. You have to go there every day and just give them a little burp, so you let rid, basically, that's letting go of all the carbon dioxide that they release.
So would it be a good idea to, say, use kilner jars or something like that?
Yeah, something like that would be good, yeah. And then after that, once you'll be able to see when the fermentation stops, when the bubbles stop, and then you can store them in the fridge or however you like.
Do you have to keep them in the dark or the light, or does it matter?
I find it's better, yeah, to keep it not necessarily in the dark, but out of straight direct sunlight. So we'll keep them in our dry stores and things like that. So I don't find they work on the windowsills.
And how long would they keep for once the fermentation has finished?
In theory, they're preserved. So they should keep for as long as you need them to.
And then when you use them, you don't need to top up the brine or anything like that?
No, you don't want anything to become uncovered, but as you're taking out the berries, you shouldn't be getting down to a level where it's low enough. You want to make sure everything's covered when you do it originally. Mm. Yeah, because if you start to get things poking out the top, then they will start to go bad. Okay. And there's a few other signs. It's best to do your research before you do it and check what you need to know to be able to ferment.
You use the internet or a book for that?
You have to remember that anyone can write on the internet.
True.
And you don't always trust everything you see. I'd say books are a lot more safer. Mm. There's a very, very affordable one, actually, written by Noma, the Danish restaurant, on fermenting. And I think it's only about £20. It goes into it in a lot more depth, but it does still have the basics in there to get you started. And that's quite a worthwhile book to get, I'd say.
So that's lacto-fermenting. Yep. Are there other types of fermenting you can do?
The other thing that I would say, the easiest way to ferment at the moment, is with honey. And that's what we're going to do with the blackberries. So honey on its own won't ferment. But if you add a little bit of liquid to honey, or, like we're going to do, add the blackberries, which will release the liquid into the honey, it then allows fermentation to happen. And that's a very easy, foolproof way of doing it. As long as everything's sterile, when you go in, you need raw honey. I mean, you can buy that from a supermarket still. I mean, it's better to buy it from a local producer or one of your mates with a beehive, but that's a very easy way. And there's plenty of recipes online, but you're literally just making sure you've got a sterile jar. Garlic is a classic way of doing it, but we'll do it with blackberries at the moment, but it'll work with anything, soft fruit, anything like that, anything that can release water. And all you're doing is letting the honey down a little bit, which will allow it to ferment with that flavour inside it.
So what do you do? Wash the blackberries first?
Yeah, a quick rinse on them, but that's not going to... You're more looking at your jars and everything being sterile, so right. Through a dishwasher or in a low oven.
As if you're making jam.
Yeah, exactly the same, yeah.
Okay. How much honey? Cover them with honey?
It just needs to be covered.
Okay. Yeah.
Again, the same with anything. If it's poking out the top, then the oxygen can get to it and things like that, and it will allow other things to grow.
But, I mean, we have our own bees and we have our own honey, but it's very solid honey, so how do you sort of plop the honey onto the blackberries, as it were?
Yeah, you'd want to heat that up a little bit, I imagine. Yeah, I've not done it with really hard honey. We normally tend to get the runnier honeys off the local bee provider.
How long does it take?
Yeah, you're looking at 2 to 3 months to finish fermenting. But you'll be able to tell because the bubbles. You can see the activity.
And again, give the jars a good shake every day?
Give them a twist, turn them upside down.
Oh, okay, that's it.
And release the lid slightly just to let the pressure go.
So if you start sort of as soon as the blackberries are ripe, or do they have to be ripe? Or
no,
can they be
actually,
semi-ripe?
You can do them with them semi-ripe. It'll be a different flavour, like we talked about last time with using unripe fruits. They have different flavours when they ripen and when they're unripe. So it does work with them when they're unripe, but we're going to be doing them when they're really juicy and ripe this year. That's the flavour I'm looking for.
And what will the flavour be like?
Well, anything fermenting, you're adding a sourness to it. So you've got the honey flavour, you've got the blackberry flavour, you've got the sweetness, but you've also got a sourness coming through as well.
So if I start doing it now, then be ready coming up for Christmas.
Yes, exactly.
Excellent. Yeah. So is there anything else?
The other things we've been having this week, we had a lovely tray of puffball mushrooms brought into the restaurant, giant puffballs.
Yes, I saw them. They were actually giant. I mean, the size of a football.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, they're very easy. I mean, the only thing you can really misidentify them for is a football. Yeah, there's not anything else like them. What you're looking for with any puffball, always cut it in half. I mean, when they get to that big size, you're cutting it in half to make sure it's not gone spore, so it's not getting old. If it's clear white in the middle, then you know you're safe and it's good to eat and it's not going to give you a dicky tummy. If it's starting to go brown or greeny colour or yellowy, then you know it's starting to go to spore, and leave that one.
Yes, unfortunately, I didn't do my research properly. I didn't talk to you properly. And I had a bit of an old one once and it wasn't so good. But no. It has to be sort of pure white, spongy.
Yeah, nice and white. They'll feel fairly firm. Mm. The older they get, they'll start to get spongy. But as long as they're white, then I've never had an issue with them.
So it's almost like the texture of the outside of a mushroom without the gills. Is that what it's like?
Yeah.
Okay.
When they're smaller, you could, I suppose, confuse them with some other mushrooms in their young age. But again, cutting them in half, as long as you open them up and they look like sponge, they have no outline of a mushroom shape in there, you're absolutely safe.
Mm. Because the one with the outline of a mushroom shape is actually a dangerous young version of a dangerous mushroom.
Yeah, people say you can confuse them for a young version of a death cap, but I find that hard. But then also, the mushrooms that I've seen people confuse over the years, I don't find it hard at the same time.
But basically, check with somebody who knows what they're talking about as far as mushrooms are concerned.
Yeah, always. Yeah, with anything, to be entirely honest, though, as long as if you can identify 100%, things like blackberries and plums and stuff, we're all brought up on, so everyone knows, and nettles and stuff like that. But if you're not 100% sure, always check with someone. Mm. It's really not worth the consequences.
Very true, very true. It'd be nice if we could take mushrooms along to chemists like they do in Finland and France and so on to identify them for us.
Quite a lot of phobia around mushrooms here. I quite often have people who say, come here and say, oh, I've had this mushroom growing in my garden. Can you identify it? Take pictures of where it is in situ, pick the mushroom, bring it into me. Oh, I can't touch it. What if it's a poisonous one? Actually, there is no mushroom in the UK that you cannot touch. You've got to physically ingest them. And there's a big phobia and a lack of knowledge around them in England, and a lot of people are scared.
Yeah.
And I think as long as you know and you learn, there's plenty of courses out there for people to go and do.
True.
You're interested in it. And I would definitely recommend doing that before you start going out and picking them yourself and eating them yourself.
Might you be running courses at one day, Steve? It'd be good if you did.
One day we will do, yes.
That'd be lovely. Oh, we'll be looking forward to hearing what will be coming up next month. And can you give us a little foretaste of what that might be?
Well, hopefully, weather permitting, we'll see what mushrooms are growing on the meadows next month.
That'll be fun.
Yep, and thanks to Steve Thompson of the Green Man in Grantchester.
Yeah, and it reminds me that this year I really must make Pontac sauce. It's made from elderberries. There's a recipe for it in Richard Mabey's book Food for Free, in which he says he heard it should be left for 7 years before consuming. So, if you're still listening in 7 years' time, tune into Flavour to find out what it's like.
Meanwhile, back with the tomato, here are Tristan Welch from Parker's Tavern, Sam Carter from Restaurant 22, and Rosie Sykes with ideas for tomatoes. Sam uses heirloom tomatoes from the Isle of Wight.
Real simple one for tomatoes, actually, is finely grate some garlic into some olive oil, and then with that, pepper, salt, and I like a bit of chopped rosemary or thyme through it as well. Toss your tomatoes in there. Oh, sorry, cut them in half first. Toss them in there in the olive oil and then pop them in the oven about 140 degrees. Now, this is crazy, for about 45 minutes. So real low, real slow cook. The juice comes out, slightly caramelizes. Go down to your local bakery, get some crusty bread, put those roasted tomatoes on the table and just dip away. And it's the most amazing sort of dip and the best tomatoes and bread you'll ever have.
We've got a dish on at the minute where we've paired it with homemade mascarpone, some lovage, and some fermented black garlic puree. And what we do with the tomatoes is prep the middle out of them and we brine them for 2 days. So a lot of people use brines for meat and fish and stuff like that. But we're using it for the tomatoes, so you penetrate the actual meat of the tomato with the flavour. So you get in the brine, we've got salt, sugar, we're using lovage stalks, some garlic, thyme, anything. It's pretty flexible, you can use anything. I've put down pink peppercorns, garlic, you can use anything really. And basically all we do is do 3 litres of water, to 200 grams salt, 200 grams sugar, and that's the base of the brine, and then all the flavourings can be mixed and matched.
And that brings the best out of the tomatoes.
Yeah, I mean, the Isle of Wight tomatoes, you get the really ripe ones, but then you get the sort of the yellow and the green, all the different like heritage mix, and then some of them can be quite firm, which really nice different textures, but you get much nicer overall eating effect by doing it. So I think it's a really good way of doing it, yeah.
One thing that I've started doing with tomatoes, which I absolutely love, is tomato tonnato. So the Italian sauce that they put on veal or pork and have as a cold dish is made with tinned tuna. It's sort of like a tuna mayonnaise. And that is absolutely delicious with tomatoes. So basically, make a mayonnaise, or you can buy a mayonnaise, add a load of tinned tuna, a clove of garlic, maybe a bit of cayenne, some lemon juice, some parsley. Make a lovely puree, as smooth as you can get it. Then I just slice a load of tomatoes, put them very flat on a plate, season them with salt and pepper, and then put over some of this tuna sauce. Then normally, traditionally with Vitello Tonnato, one would put slices of anchovy in a sort of grid and then drop capers into each of the noughts and crosses hole, which is lovely, or some pieces of boiled egg. But I do think tomatoes as well work really well with a hard-boiled egg in a salad. I love to cook with tomatoes as well. Tomatoes with fennel braised are really delicious. I'm afraid it is worth peeling them in that case, but sometimes they peel themselves in the braise and you can just lift out the skins. Little tiny tomatoes, I love to roast them with some lemon thyme and garlic and make almost like a very simple pepperonata with some red peppers and some red onion. And again, that's lovely to make pepperades with a scrambled egg or something, or just eat like that with some goat's cheese or whatever.
And a little later in the programme, we'll be hearing from local chef Jamie Mountford from the Elsesley with another idea. There's the familiar music signalling time for the latest food tweets from the city.
And Steve Thompson from the Green Man in Grantchester has tweeted, one of their many specials this weekend is duck in stout, offal, malted potato, jack in the hedge and bullus. Roberto's Deli is trading in the Grand Arcade by John Lewis today, and also in the market opposite Marks and Spencer's. No Brewbought tap room in Harston today, and Calverley's Brewery in Hooper Street has Pizza Mondo serving. And they're the tweets for Saturday.
Yeah, and don't forget you can keep up with what we're tweeting by following us at Flavour 105.
Tomatoes feature in this next piece too. I went to Vanderlyle in Mill Road the other day to ask Alex Rushmer and Lawrence Butler how they were getting on. Extremely well, it seems.
We've been sold out every single service that we've been open. We've been fully booked. We've been at capacity for the last 4 months, and it looks like it's going to continue right up until October as well.
We feel very fortunate to have the support that we've got from the community around here. It's been fabulous. Mm.
So it says, when I've checked on your website, that you do accept the odd walk-in. Does that actually happen?
If we had the space, we would do. We've been in a fortunate, very fortunate position where we've known before service every single day that we have 26 people coming for dinner, and that's all we can fit into the restaurant. We've got some really interesting things on at the moment, actually. Yeah, we're doing savoury dishes with strawberries. We've done sweet dishes with tomatoes. We've done sweet dishes with herbs. We always try and put something slightly unusual. Something when people read the menu, they might raise an eyebrow, but hopefully by the end of the meal, they know they've been in safe hands.
Where do you get your inspiration from?
Oh, a mixture of things, really. We're drawing influences from all over, really. Alex is an avid reader, and I'm an avid eater, so between the two of us, we have a lot of thoughts to discuss.
How far in advance do you plan the menu?
I'd like to say that it was a fairly organised process, but that would be something of an untruth. Mm. The menu is relatively stable, but we're small enough that we're able to respond very quickly to changes in produce, or we might get a call from a supplier to say that we've got a glut of tomatoes in, and we'll change the menu depending on that. But generally, the menu is fixed for us for a week. We change one or two dishes a week. We aim to change the whole menu over the course of a month.
Do you use organic produce mainly?
We haven't been dogmatic about anything that we cook. We're not even dogmatic about the fact that we just cook vegetables. We just happen to be cooking vegetables at the moment. Whether it's coincidence or by design, the best vegetables that we can get our hands on are locally grown and organic. We use the majority of what we put on the menu comes from Flourish Produce in Hildesheim, a truly inspirational farm only eight or so miles from the restaurant.
About as organic as you can possibly get.
We've paid several visits there, and every time we go, it is a source of just amazing inspiration. And the produce is next level. It's the best produce. It really is the best produce that we can get our hands on. And what matters to us most is sustainability, and I think that's very, very closely linked with organic farming and organic farming practices, or not necessarily certified organic, but people who are following organic methods without the certification. I think all these things are they've almost become incidental to us because we take them for granted, I suppose. Instead of the menu being chef-driven and us saying, okay, well, we want to put aubergines on the menu, it's much more in line with what is available to us at this particular moment in time.
How do you see the period between now and Christmas and now and your anniversary in April panning out?
Yeah, well, I mean, essentially, it's going to be more of the same, reacting to what's fresh and produced locally, and planning exciting menus based entirely around that.
And also, you don't follow any particular cuisine of any particular, you know, sort of Ottolenghi style or anything like that.
Do you know, I've been thinking about this for quite a lot recently. There's an awful lot of Italian influences in what we do. We're not too hung up on technique. We're much more about letting the produce sing and do the hard work for us and use our menu as a showcase for what people are growing locally rather than hiding it in lots of, you know, cream sauces and overly reduced and overly complicated preparations. That's not to say we don't take a lot of effort in what we do. I'm just looking at the menu now. We have a salad on. The first course that we do is a salad. And tonight it's 32 different ingredients in the salad. So that's a good example of what we do. And that takes time to... Some of it is raw, some of it is cooked, some of it is braised, some of it is foraged, some of it is super fresh. And, you know, it all comes into the restaurant. It all has to be washed and prepped and carefully assembled and kept in perfect conditions. So there's a huge amount of work just in that one dish, but we find it enormously satisfying and a really good, a really good snapshot of what is available and what is absolutely spectacular on this particular day.
Can you give me an example of a couple of your other dishes on your menu at the moment?
We have a saffron risotto, very delicious thing, but I think Alex mentioned earlier we've been using some strawberries to create a kind of savoury element. So on top of this, we've made what's called a strawberry sofrito. So essentially we've taken onions, fennel and pine nuts and cooked them down with the strawberries for about 7 to 8 hours, and they almost start taking on kind of a beefy kind of flavour. So really savoury, really unctuous, a little touch of sweetness still, but mainly kind of a savoury flavour. This has been a really interesting one to get people to try because they take a mouthful expecting something and it's completely different. Yeah, do you want to explain another?
Yeah, I think the main course actually is a good one. We're here right at the start of August. Courgettes and tomatoes. It's very simple, but we have the best courgettes and the best tomatoes, and we make a fresh tomato sauce with tomatoes that have never been in the fridge. So they come into our kitchen twice a week. We don't store them in the fridge, and then we make a fresh tomato sauce before service every single day. And the courgettes, again, they're plucked from the field, and they come straight into the kitchen, and we cook them very simply. There's a few other things that we do. We do a courgette puree, we do a little courgette bread, but really it is a showcase of two items that are just at their absolute best at this time of year.
What about the hungry gap, or the bit where there's, you know, there's not so much veg around, mainly kale, Brussels sprouts, exciting things, with all the root veg and so on. How do you see that?
I think there's going to be a really interesting transition to those bigger, heartier, bolder flavours. And actually, something that we try and focus on in our cooking is concentration of flavour. And when you're dealing with bigger, bolder flavours, like beetroots and brassicas, actually, that possibly makes our job a little bit easier. We're currently doing a tomato jus, and that takes a lot of work and a lot of effort to pull out some dark caramelised flavours. Whereas with a celeriac, it's actually a little bit easier. So we'll see. The salad might not get up to 32 separate ingredients, but we'll certainly try to keep it on the menu if we can. And if we can do a salad with 15 or 20 different ingredients, it's still a part of our philosophy of being that showcase of what's good at a particular moment in time. And we'll see what happens in November.
Okay. We look forward to the challenge.
So if you want a book at Van der Lyle, I suggest look on the website and book at least 2 to 3 weeks at least ahead.
I think at the moment we're booking about six weeks ahead. Mm. We've just launched availability for October, and we will be launching availability for November at the start of September.
Okay, so keep an eye on Twitter and certainly on your website.
Keep an eye on Twitter, and if you would like to book a table, you need to go to exploretalk.com/Van der Lyle.
Yes, and very big thanks there to Alex Rushmer and Lawrence Butler from Van der Lyle.
Our final look at tomatoes today is with Jamie Mountford of the Eltersley in Eltersley, off the A428.
Tomatoes are fantastic vegetarian alternatives in the restaurants. You can concuss them. When I say concuss them, you blanch them in boiling hot water for 5 to 10 seconds, and then you put them in ice cold water to scrape the skin off. This will just give you a more delicate tomato, really. It's really fantastic flavour. And then basically I create a dish in the restaurant where I use heirloom tomatoes. So heirloom are your different coloured tomatoes, different types of tomatoes. So you get greens, yellows, reds, purples, in fact. You know, it's fantastic. And what I tend to do is slice them up however you want, because you get different heights and how you slice them in different ways, and then plenty of salt, bring out the flavour again, especially on tomatoes, fantastic. And then what I tend to do is dress the dish with some balsamic pearls. Now balsamic pearls is just balsamic vinegar, bit of agar, and then what I do is put them into a syringe, put them into ice cold water, and it sets. And then this will leave an explosion on the dish in your mouth rather than it being everywhere, really. And then I get feta cheese. If you're doing a vegan dish, use a bit of tofu, you know, and blowtorch it. So what you're doing is burning the outside. When I say blowtorch, you know, it's what the you use for a creme brulee, so to speak. The gas comes out, and then you just torch away at the cheese on the dish. Don't do it on the side of the dish, because it will just melt. This will add a bit of burnt flavour, a bit of bitterness to it. It's absolutely fantastic. And then what I tend to do is make a rocket pesto. So you're talking Parmesan, garlic, rocket, pine nuts. So put them in the food processor, mix a bit of olive oil in there, scatter this on the dish, and yeah, you've got a fantastic presentation dish which is vegetarian or vegan.
Tell me a bit more detail about how you make the balsamic pearls.
The balsamic pearls is so you get your balsamic vinegar, and then you bring it up to a simmer, add your agar to it.
So what about quantities?
So what I tend to do, to every 100 grams of vinegar, I use 10 grams of agar. And this, when you put it into your syringe, what I tend to use is syringes. You know, if you've got one of these syringes that you use for cowpole with the kids, you can use one arm, basically.
Right.
And then
you fill it. So you've melted agar.
Yeah, yeah.
Into the balsamic vinegar,
yeah.
You put it into the syringe, and then force that little droplet.
You force little droplets out, but as to say ice water, and I actually meant to say olive oil. So you drop it into olive oil, and then you put it in the freezer. And then what tends to happen is it freezes, and then you put it on the dish, and then it gently melts. But it creates a little film around the outside as well with the agar.
Yeah.
So a bit of science and a bit of fun, really. If you want to try it out with the kids, do it. You know what I mean?
Tremendous.
Just don't give it them instead of medicine.
From tomatoes to green onions, signalling the start of our news section. And very brief today, but we begin as usual with jobs.
Brewdog, opening soon in Bennett Street, is looking for kitchen staff. You'll need at least a year's experience in a busy kitchen. Apply via the Brewdog website, where you'll find more details.
The Ivy in Trinity Street has a vacancy for a head chef. Apply via the Ivy website.
Yeah, and good luck if you're applying. Please mention that you heard about your positions on Flavour here on Cambridge 105 Radio. And if you want to advertise in this slot, please email sales@cambridge105.co.uk.
Time for a couple of news items. Parker's Tavern in Regent Street is now serving a dish of the day at lunchtime, and it comes with a complimentary glass of wine. I went as their guest last Friday and had a superb pork belly with a very well-matched glass of red.
But some less good news, the GOG Sundowner sessions have been cancelled tonight, Saturday, because of the weather, but there'll be more to come.
And that's all the time we have for today. We are here on alternate Saturdays at 1, repeated on Sunday at 2, and this Tuesday at 1 p.m, and podcast early in the next week.
And coming up next on Cambridge 105 Radio is Women Making Waves. At 3 o'clock, Twin Talk. 4 o'clock, What You Might Have Missed. 5 o'clock, The Football Show. 6, Chris Brown's Soul and Dance. 8, Centuries of Sound. 9, Paul Cristoforou. And 11, Club Beats. But that's all from us. We'll be back on the 31st of August. But until then,
goodbye.
Goodbye.